And we are a go. Hi, everyone. Welcome to the Physionic Podcast, or welcome back to the Physionic Podcast. If you're unfamiliar with who I am, my name is Nicholas Verhoeven. I'm a PhD student in molecular medicine and a cell biology researcher. Today, we're going to be going through the second part of a three-part podcast wherein we'll be discussing how nutrition affects depression symptoms. And in the first part, if you haven't listened to that, I certainly encourage that you check that out. In the first part, we talked about inflammation, we talked about mitochondrial dysfunction, and we talked about oxidative stress. So those were the three factors that would affect depression and how nutrition, particular nutrients, could affect those three factors. And they're pretty major factors. In this episode, we're going to be going into the gut microbiota. Not a whole lot, however, because I have done very little research in the gut microbiota. And although I did interview someone, a friend of mine, who does research in the microbiome, I am not incredibly familiar with it yet, so it's something that I need to look more into. But I do have several notes based off of this scientific review. The second factor that we're going to be discussing is the HPA axis, which, if you're not familiar with what that is, don't worry, I will explain that. And finally, the third factor is neurogenesis and BDNF, or brain-derived neurotrophic factor. And then at the end of the podcast, I'll give you kind of the big takeaways that we can walk away with. Okay, so just like last time, this information is provided to us through a scientific review called Diet and Depression, Exploring the Biological Mechanisms of Action. And that's essentially what we're going to be doing. We're going to be explaining the biological mechanisms, and then we'll go into some of the different nutritional interventions that we can employ that will hopefully, based off of the studies that have been done on this topic, specifically related to depression, alleviate some of those depressive symptoms. And hopefully I'll do a better job explaining my way through this than I did last time, because last time was a lot of really complex information. It's really difficult to distill that down in one go, but hopefully I didn't do too badly of a job. If you're watching the podcast, if you're listening, don't worry about it. As usual, I'll be explaining everything. But if you are watching, I will have a few graphics for you to kind of hammer home a few points so you can actually see what some of these things look like as I go through them. Okay, so just as a bit of background, studies have shown, and I've mentioned this in the past podcast, that studies have shown that in the past that nutrition interventions can have a small effect on depression symptoms. But other studies have actually not found that it doesn't have an effect, but it actually has a much greater effect. So we're within this range of, like, there is a small effect to there's a pretty sizable effect from nutrition, or how nutrition can affect our brain. And we'll be discussing several of those. So, and this is especially telling if a person has severe depression, so major depressive disorder, or just generally has symptoms of severe depression. They tend to get the most benefit, reap the most benefit or reward from nutrition intervention. And then we also mentioned last podcast that a great example of this is like the Mediterranean diet that's been reported through a few different studies to lead to significant reductions in depressive symptoms. And this review focuses on possible mechanisms and why these dietary interventions may be beneficial to depressive people. Okay, so let's jump into the gut microbiota. Again, keep in mind that I'm not incredibly educated on this yet, so I'm going to be kind of mostly going off of what the review says. And for the other two areas, I definitely know quite a bit more, so I'll be able to kind of fill in some more holes. The gut microbiota is something that there's just so much research that still needs to be done, and it's a really fascinating area of research, just studying the microbiome as a whole, not just in the gut, but certainly that's what we're focused on here because, well, the gut, I guess I don't really need to explain it, but if I do, nutrition, right, goes into the gut and then gets absorbed in the gut, goes into the intestines and gets absorbed. Now, within that intestinal lining, within the intestines themselves, if that's the small intestine or the large intestine, the colon, you have this kind of grouping of all kinds of different cells, all kinds of different bacteria, even viruses, fungi. I mean, you've got a bunch of different things that live in your intestines, and the makeup of that seems to have a pretty profound impact on our health. And that is, I mean, that is just the tip of what we know. I mean, there's so much more we have to yet figure out, which makes this area of research one of the most exciting for the next 10, 20 years to come. But anyway, so the microbiota has been implicated in having an effect on cognitive function. So animal studies have already shown that there's a link between food consumption, just in general food consumption, the microbiota, so again, those kind of bacteria and viruses and stuff like that that are found in our intestines, and depression symptoms. So there's been some pretty cool experiments that have looked at this, but changing the gut microbiota by nutrition seems to actually change behavior. So think about that, right? Like you're changing the composition of what is in your intestine, what lives in your intestine, and that changes mood. That's pretty stunning. We focus so much on the brain, and the brain is, I mean, it's critical, right? That there's nothing to be taken away from that. But the point is that you can change something that's in your intestines, and it can have an effect on your mood, which is related to your brain. Which is, I mean, to just dive into that line of research would be super cool to look into. So, for example, high-fat Western diets seem to change the ratio between two bacteria, and change the behavior of rodents where that ratio changed. Sometimes you can have kind of the complete depletion of a particular type of bacterium that serves a particular function. And what that function is, sometimes we don't know. And then you see the rise of another bacterium that can get in the way and start to fester or start to build up over time. So you have one bacteria in your intestines, then you consume high fat or Western diet in general, filled with, you know, trans fats, saturated fats, all kinds of other things. And then that can lead to a shift to a different dominant type of microbiota that's found in the microbiome of your intestines. So with that change in behavior in the rodents, they also realized or saw an effect in reduced memory as well as anxiety-like behavior. So think, I mean, we're not just talking about depression here. We're talking about memory and general cognitive function, and we're talking about anxiety. So imagine if some people were able to lessen their anxiety, if they just have maybe general anxiety disorder, or if they do have something really severe like a panic disorder, or a combination of the two, if they're able to maybe lessen those based off of the foods that they consume, how incredible would that be? So in line with this animal research, clinical studies, so studies that have been done in humans, have shown that high calorie diets increase the abundance of certain bacteria, and also showed impaired object recognition and social cue recognition. So I believe, I didn't look into this too much, but they had these people end up in these different social situations after consuming, you know, a particular nutrition profile, and they saw an association with a change in how those people behaved. So, I mean, that's I'm going to take that with a grain of salt, because it's, you know, obviously people are incredibly complex. So the reasons for that might be multifaceted. And certainly it also depends on how they go about that study. But still, to show some difference is interesting, at least. Prebiotics made of fructo and galacto oligosaccharides, those are carbohydrate chains, reverse some of the stress-induced changes in the gut microbiota by maintaining the presence of beneficial microbes, microbes again being those bacteria that I was talking about, in the gut, like lactobacillus, as well as reduce pro-inflammatory cytokines and depressive behavior in mice. Now, I always have qualms with how they determine if a mouse shows depressive symptoms. That's certainly something to keep in mind. But people that actually are in that line of research would probably be able to defend it far better than I would. But still, assuming that, let's say that's a rigorous way of measuring if mice are exhibiting depressive symptoms, this already goes to some of the points that we discussed last week, where we talked about pro-inflammatory cytokines. We talked about inflammation being one of those factors that's been highly related to this increase in depression, or related to depression in general. And in the next section in this podcast, we're going to go into stress and how that affects the overall depressive symptoms. So apparently, through these prebiotics, they were able to ameliorate some of these stress-induced changes to depressive behavior. And we'll go into that more in the next section. So interestingly, in some situations, they transfer microbiota from one animal to another. So one animal is put on a high-fat diet, the specific diet that leads to changes in the microbiota that would be considered unfavorable. And then they measure sort of depressive symptoms, or they measure changes in behavior. They just observe mice, for example, over a set amount of time. They put some mice on that high-fat diet. They put other mice on what would be considered kind of a healthier diet for mice. And then they swap the microbiota across. So they usually have to cut into the mice, get the some of the microbiota samples, and then swap them into the other mice. Obviously, they have to live. So it's like a surgery. And then they observe if the behavior changes between the mice. And what they find is that, yes, it does. So this, I mean, that's great evidence right there that the microbiota can have an impact in terms of not only mood, but certainly also behavior overall. The implications of that could be pretty serious. So again, I keep saying it, it's super interesting. I really hope that we'll get some more answers on this in the next 10 to 20 years. I mean, think about the amount of information we're still trying to learn about the ocean, the amount of information we're trying to learn about history, what we're trying to learn about space. There's so much we still have to figure out about our own biology, our own physiology, our own body. It's really mind-boggling. So what are a few things that have been shown to have some of these effects? Well, like we mentioned, prebiotics, although that's still debated in the field, you still have things like really basic things like fiber. So, and I have articles and videos on fiber, that fiber should be kind of seen on a continuum. It's not like you just have one type of fiber and then another type of fiber. They're really diverse. There's all kinds of different fibers. So just in general, consuming fiber ends up going through a fermentation process in the large intestine. And this fermentation process means that you get this conversion from fiber, which is not broken down in the small intestine. So when you consume fiber, it doesn't get broken down like other carbohydrates, which would normally get broken down into their monomer forms, into their single molecule forms, and then absorbed through the intestine and put into the bloodstream. Fiber doesn't go through that. It's the structure of it. It can't be broken down. So what happens is it goes to the large intestine, and there we have particular bacteria that do have the capability. They essentially feed off of this fiber, and that's beneficial to us because it ends up producing, they end up going through this fermentation process wherein they produce short chain fatty acids. So these fatty acids then can be absorbed, and that apparently leads to changes in some level of change in immunity, if that's positive or negative. They didn't really go into detail with that. So with the gut microbiota also having some impact on the bioavailability of these nutrients. Bioavailability meaning that if you consume something, will it actually be absorbed? Because not everything is absorbed. If you consume something, usually if it's like a nutrient, if it's like a carbohydrate, like if you were to consume a carbohydrate in isolation, usually that gets absorbed almost completely, like 98% gets absorbed. But you do have these combinations of different foods, and especially if you're talking about something that may be more processed, that it could interact with some of these processing molecules that could lead to changes in the actual absorption. So then that would decrease the bioavailability of that nutrient. That's not even just based off of just their absorption, also what ends up happening once it's in the bloodstream. But ultimately, the microbiota can have an impact on this actual absorption through the intestines. So there is also evidence, although it's pretty variable and limited, that a small amount of research shows that being exposed to particular combinations of bacteria, and this is kind of going back to my microbiota example where they're transferring from one mouse to the other mouse, that being just exposed to particular bacteria does change mental health, improving depressive symptoms and anxiety. So again, this is far more, it's far reaching. It's far beyond just looking at just depression, but obviously I wanted to focus this podcast on that. And finally, that microbiota may also have some control over food sensitivities. That does not shock me at all, with depressed people experiencing higher food sensitivity. Now, they did throw in the percentage here. It's about a 4% increase. Is that relevant? To be honest, I don't know. I have my doubts. So we're gonna kind of hold off on that. But to say that the microbiota would have an impact on food sensitivity in general is not a stretch. That seems completely plausible by me. Okay, so that was very much based off of the notes that I had from this particular scientific review. Now I can go into stuff that I know quite a bit more on, and we'll actually go into more specifically like what nutrients can be used to actually help this whole process of fighting depression or depressive symptoms. Okay, so the next one is the HPA axis. Okay, so the HPA axis, which is a shortened version of saying the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis, which is really two parts of the brain, just parts of the brain that end up interacting with the adrenal glands, that is a system that allows for the production of cortisol. Now, cortisol has been, you've probably heard it before, that's been highly related to stress, with people reacting differently to the amounts of cortisol that are released. But it's at least associated with higher levels of cortisol. You typically have an association, or that's the assumption, that you typically have higher levels of stress. So this HPA axis is what is responsible for the production of this cortisol. Now, the reason why I mention this is because increased cortisol is also associated not with just like increased stress, but also with neuropsychiatric disorders, with over 60% of people with depression exhibiting excess cortisol production. So that's a big one. Okay, so how does this HPA axis work? It is a normal thing. It's supposed to work. So I don't want you walking away from this thinking that if this is like you need to knock down your HPA axis all the time. The point being that you just have a system and it just simply generates too much cortisol. So the HPA axis is a communication between the hypothalamus of the brain, So the hypothalamus releases a hormone called corticotropin-releasing hormone, and then that will bind just south of the hypothalamus is the pituitary. And the pituitary gland will then release adrenocorticotropic hormone, which it's like a whole cascade. And then that will leave the brain or leave the area of the brain and will go to right above the kidneys. On top of your kidneys, you have these pudgy things. That's how I always describe them. And those are the adrenals. And the adrenal gland will then be bound by ACTH, again, that adrenocorticotropic hormone, which then leads to the stimulation of the adrenal cortex to produce cortisol. Now, usually what would happen is cortisol would then feed back to the hypothalamus, bind the hypothalamus, and downregulate the hypothalamus's release of CRH, again, that corticotropin-releasing hormone. And it can also do that on the pituitary. But clearly, for people with that 60% of people that deal with depression that have elevated cortisol, clearly something is going wrong there. Clearly, they're producing cortisol and it's not having that feedback mechanism onto the hypothalamus or the pituitary. So, and something really cool that they mention, although unfortunate, is that apparently in early childhood, if a person has trauma in early childhood, that can lead to dysregulation of this HPA axis. So I'm going to abbreviate it from now on to HPA axis. It's, again, just to repeat, the hypothalamic pituitary adrenal axis that produces this cortisol. So it can lead to dysregulation of this HPA axis. They don't go into detail of how exactly it gets dysregulated, but again, you're supposed to have this cortisol that then feeds back after it's produced and released from the adrenals. It's supposed to circulate through the bloodstream and eventually end up, again, binding the brain to tell it, hey, we don't need any more of this. We already have enough of it. But it's possible that these individuals have some sort of change. Maybe it's some sort of genetic change, whatever it could be. I don't know. Maybe it's an epigenetic change that leads to this insensitivity to cortisol, or they just produce more of it no matter what. Even if they have this feedback mechanism, they still produce a lot of it. Or it just doesn't get degraded. I mean, there's all kinds of different reasons as to why. But the point is that a person can go through trauma and have elevated cortisol as a result for long term. And that can increase the risk for mental disorder later in life. So in this situation, we're talking about depression. So for example, they've also shown this in animals experiencing maternal deprivation. So just being taken away from their mothers extremely earlier in life, have an altered HPA response to stress in adulthood, with, again, an impaired memory. So although we are talking about depression, we're also just seeing that there are some pretty significant changes that occur to the brain in general. As we're going to talk about the hippocampus in the next section, so I'll wait to discuss that further. Okay, so that's kind of the big picture. We've got increases in cortisol. Great. All right. And that's associated with a lot of people that have depression, but not everyone, but a lot of people, 60%. So what can be done? That's one of the big questions. So clinical trials have been done with vitamin C that have reported reductions in cortisol. So this is specifically trying to target this cortisol, assuming that then cortisol has an impact on depression, which we don't have necessarily conclusive evidence of that, but things are leaning that way so far. So vitamin C is reported to reduce cortisol release to acute stress in adults. So if you have this, let's say, I don't know, maybe they have people watch a video and then they've got these like scary moments. Like, you know, if you're watching a horror movie, you typically get kind of stressed out unless you're not a scaredy cat like me, which I totally am. I can't watch horror movies without... I'm closing my eyes like 80% of the time, because in that my situation, then that would mean that my cortisol levels would be high. It's not quite that simplistic, but you get my point. So a person gets exposed to something stressful, an acute stress, and then they showed that vitamin C reduces some of that, kind of blunts some of that cortisol release. Another one is omega-3s, which is actually something we talked about last episode as well. And I believe vitamin C we talked about last week as well, showed improved cortisol levels in healthy individuals. So as well as, I should mention this because that's what the podcast is on, also in people that deal with depression. So pretty big deal. Omega-3s are just things that you can get from like eating fish, or you can just get it from krill oil or fish oil, whatever you prefer. There's other things as well, like polyphenols, which again, we talked about last time, but there are a few differences here, mainly because they're focusing on pomegranate juice and dark chocolate. So this does not apply, however, to milk chocolate. So, you know, you can't gorge yourself on chocolate and then just say, I'm cured. It doesn't quite work that way. But it does seem that dark chocolate does seem to have an effect, and I'll tell you why, in reducing cortisol. And this was shown over a four-week trial where people consumed dark chocolate and experienced decreases in overall cortisol levels, as well as morning cortisol levels. And the reason why they specifically report on morning cortisol levels is because at the beginning of our day, we do tend to have the highest levels of cortisol levels, and then they kind of taper off. And I, for the life of me, I can't find this study, but a long time ago, like 5 years ago, I found this study that showed the differences between men and women. And they showed that men taper their cortisol, or kind of have this rise in cortisol, and then it just kind of plummets again. It's pretty quick to get rid of cortisol, elevated cortisol. And women tend to have a much more tapered decline over the day. So I thought that was really interesting. I'd love to actually look into what those mechanisms were, if I can even find that study again. So morning cortisol is elevated, but dark chocolate reduces it. And the other one is cortisone. So you maybe have heard of like cortisone shots. That's not exactly what we're talking about here. Cortisone is a precursor to cortisol. So in the production of cortisol in the adrenals, you have cortisone that then gets converted to cortisol. But then on top of that, cortisol can also be broken down so that it gets turned into cortisone. Now, the reason why I mention that is because cortisone is a metabolite of cortisol, is not as potent as cortisol, but it still has some biological activity, therefore increasing overall stress levels. So the mechanism for how dark chocolate does that is unknown, but potentially it's just because dark chocolate is good. I mean, for those people, they're like, oh, I just need to eat this chocolate. It very much depends in that kind of study. Do they have a comparable control? Do they have a comparable something else to compare against? Because if you just give one group chocolate and the other group no chocolate, who do you think is going to be more stressed out? It doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure that out. So they would have to give one group, let's say dark chocolate, and the other group, let's say milk chocolate, or give them, I don't know, Sour Patch Kids or, you know, something like that, and see if, without telling them, hey, this is what we're going to study, and see what actually happens in terms of a biological response. And further, on top of the dark chocolate, a high glycemic diet, so foods that are carbohydrate heavy, that are high glycemic specifically, and to caveat that, if you're consuming a high glycemic diet, that essentially means that you're consuming straight carbs, because the glycemic index just gets thrown straight out the window the moment you start pairing that with proteins and fats and other things like that. So I think this is probably going to have limited implications. But a high glycemic diet has been implicated with small increases in cortisol. And probiotics have removed that enhanced activity by the HPA axis. So again, kind of going back to those pre and probiotics earlier, which again, a lot of that is still debated. So, and this was done in animals. So they separated them again from their mothers, which creates that stressful environment, especially later in life. And those animals were exposed to then different stressors. And they found that it had an effect. So feeding them a high glycemic diet or changing their nutrition in terms of the addition of probiotics. So then also preliminary clinical trials, so this is in humans, show that multicultural probiotics decrease cortisol and decrease self-reported stress outcomes compared to placebo in healthy individuals. So again, here, this is a similar trial was also done in depressed individuals. So not just people that don't have depression, but also in people that did have depression, and they did not find a difference in cortisol between the two groups. So in that situation, that probiotic, that multicultural probiotic helped the people presumably that did not have depression, but it did not help the people who did have depression. So for the actual functional outcome, the real world outcome of what we're interested in, depression, at least based off of this information, it doesn't seem like a probiotic would be helpful. But again, you know, so much of this stuff has yet to be vetted and figured out. More studies kind of replicating, changing certain variables to really hammer down a lot of this information. So polyphenols, pomegranate juice, dark chocolate, omega-3s, and vitamin C, though, have some decent evidence based on what we've seen so far to be helpful. Okay, now allow me to go into the final one, which is the final factors, neurogenesis and BDNF. This is a really cool area. This is probably the one I was most excited about. Okay, so I mentioned earlier the hippocampus. The hippocampus is a section of the brain, not to be confused with what I mentioned earlier as well, the hypothalamus. The hypothalamus and the hippocampus are two different areas of the brain. So the hippocampus is kind of next to the hypothalamus. I guess it doesn't really matter where. But it's highly implicated in, it has a central role in learning, memory, and mood. And in animal studies, they've shown that neurogenesis, which is the production, the birth, the generation of more neurons. Neurons are brain cells that allow us to communicate information from one side of our brain to another side of our brain, as well as throughout our entire body. So the way that we actually move is due to neurons. That is linked to cognition and mood. And I spoke about this a little bit last podcast as well, that if you have a greater brain volume, that is typically seen as a healthy sign of a lack of depression. So there's an inverse relationship. So I guess I'll say the opposite. If the brain volume, so the amount of brain matter decreases, there's higher levels of depression. And the opposite is true as well. So that's why this neurogenesis idea is something that people are interested in, scientists are interested in, researchers interested in, are interested in, to try and preserve that. So one of the areas that people focus on is BDNF. So BDNF is a neurotrophin, meaning that it is a molecule that induces survival and development of these neurons. And it's highly elevated in the hippocampus because you need to have constant remodeling of those neurons. You need to have constant changes. Like a single cell, a single neuron needs to be able to create what are called dendritic spines and to be able to change the way that it communicates through its axons, the way that it receives messages. I realize I'm kind of using particular words that you may or may not be familiar with. The point is that these neurons change the way that they physically appear, okay? And that gives them a benefit to how they communicate with other neurons around them. And this communication back and forth, that this change is called neural plasticity or synaptic plasticity. Both can be used relatively interchangeably right now. So BDNF is a key molecule for synaptic plasticity and cell metabolism. And specifically in cell metabolism, it actually increases glucose utilization. It increases blood sugar utilization, I guess I should say in this situation, brain sugar utilization. And it also changes and increases lactate utilization. I'm not going to go into lactate. That's like a whole metabolism lecture. I could easily go into it, but essentially I'll just give you a brief rundown. Like when you use glucose at the one of the end products of the use of a glucose molecule, of a sugar molecule inside your cells is lactate. And your body's highly efficient because it can export lactate back out of itself and send it to another cell to be used for energy as well. It's a ridiculously cool process. And I want to say it's called the Cori cycle. I hope I didn't get that wrong. My professors would be so mad at me. I think that might be right though. So anyway, you've got the cycling of lactate, which can be used for energy as well. And the big thing with BDNF though, is that it increases sodium dependent amino acid import. So what that means is that in the cell, you have these transporters that will move to, or you can build these transporters that are embedded into the cell membrane. And they are dictated, their use, their ability to function is dictated by the sodium that's in the extracellular environment, in the fluid environment outside of the neuron. And so if you've got sodium, which you have to have sodium, if you don't have sodium, you die. So if you're listening to this, you have sodium. The BDNF will bind or lead to the general expression and production of more of these transporters. So these transporters then allow, with the aid of sodium, to move amino acids, so protein building blocks, into themselves. And why that's important and why BDNF might have this action is because it leads to better development of the neurons. So the more of these amino acids that you have around, the more potential you have for protein synthesis. And the more protein synthesis you have, potentially, not always, but potentially, you could have increases in the building blocks, the important molecules being produced from these amino acids that are being imported. Now, people, however, that have depression or have depressive symptoms tend to have lower levels of BDNF. And that's why this review kind of focused on it, trying to kind of hone in on the idea of looking at BDNF and the potential role that it has. So depressive people have lower levels of BDNF, and BDNF has been implicated in having a protective mechanism or action against depressive disorders, most likely through its impact on neurons themselves. So there's good evidence that BDNF levels can be improved by diet. So in animal studies, they've shown that a Western diet, again, high in fat and sucrose, reduces BDNF levels in the hippocampus specifically. So they focus a lot on the hippocampus that we mentioned earlier. And adversely impacts cognitive performance. So not just talking about depression, but also just your ability to think. Meanwhile, the addition of, and we're going back to omega-3s, so again, the addition of omega-3s and vitamins, like vitamin C, seem to improve these BDNF levels. On top of that, the addition of compounds or different molecules or different nutrients or different foods, like resveratrol, which you may be familiar with. That is something that kind of became big like over the like 10 years, something like that. I hope to actually create some content on that at some point. So some compounds like resveratrol, again, I think I mentioned this last podcast, so I mean, it's good to see this kind of cross-pollination. So, you know, we're not stacking up all these different nutrients that a person has to take, but blueberries, green tea, curcumin, those are all things that I've mentioned in the past, and cacao also has an impact, and that's probably why dark chocolate has its impact, if we had to speculate. So all of those show an ability to preserve the integrity of hippocampal neurogenesis, so that production of neurons, or just the general positive change in neuroplasticity. Now, on top of that, however, they also seem to be able to reverse some of the decrements that occur in psychopathologies and aging, like depression. Now, and even on top of that, they've also found that fasting seems to also, like periodic fasting, seems to also have a benefit. So calorie intake, so lowering calorie intake as well as fasting, and I've mentioned that I would love to kind of have that distinction between the two. Is it the fasting? Is it the calorie reduction? Is it both at the same time that have their impact? But regardless, the point being that fasting seems to have a positive impact as well. And it seems to have a positive impact specifically to hippocampal neurogenesis. So observational studies have also been done. So not studies where the scientists are like, okay, we're going to give you this, you guys are going to get this, and then we're going to go from, and then we're going to measure and compare between the two groups. Observational studies are just scientists that just kind of sit back and they pick a group of people that they're going to observe, and then they kind of observe them over time, or they maybe they even compare them against another group that they observe, but they don't actually create some sort of manipulation. They don't actually intervene in some way. They don't try and control the variables around them. So it's informative, but it's tough to make causative claims, or it's almost impossible to make causative claims based off of observational studies. But observational studies have seen a correlation between a healthier diet and larger hippocampal volume. And I talked to you about how the volume of the brain has been, again, also associated with depression. And that, interestingly enough, is independent of age, sex, and education. So big three factors, age, sex, and education. It didn't matter if a person consumed a healthy diet, that tended to have improvements in hippocampal volume. And again, the hippocampus has an impact on learning, memory, and mood. So then they also ended up looking at randomized trials. So people with depression were randomized, and this is going back to the Mediterranean diet, to consume a Mediterranean diet with, I forgot to write this down, but I think they also supplemented with nuts of some sort. I don't remember exactly what type, almonds or something along those lines, or walnuts, and had higher levels of plasma BDNF. Now, the caution against taking that, running with it, and just saying, oh, the Mediterranean diet immediately increases BDNF and therefore it's healthy, and that's, you know, it's leading to improvements in brain volume and whatnot. One of the difficulties with that is that plasma levels, although it is indicative of a lot, it may not be indicative of the brain specifically. So what you would want to know is, are you seeing specific changes in the brain itself? And they do caution against that. And that was over 3 years, plasma BDNF levels were elevated in the Mediterranean diet group compared to the control group. Again, depends what the control group was consuming as well. But And I wrote down here, but systemic BDNF may not be indicative of central levels, so specific to the brain. Although it's still pretty good evidence, because BDNF does have positive effects on other parts of the body as well, even if we separate that out from depression. And then the last note that I've got here, which is something I already mentioned, is calorie restriction, including periodic fasting, increases BDNF levels. So there you go. Okay, so those are the big three. Those are the big three factors that I want to discuss this podcast. We're going to go into the takeaway, kind of the big points that we can take away from this. And then I would encourage that you stick around for next week's podcast, where I'll be discussing obesity, epigenetics, and I can't remember the other one, another factor, looking at, again, depression. So that'll be part three, and it'll close out our breakdown of how nutrition can affect and nutrition and different mechanisms affect depression. So the big takeaways, gut microbiota likely have some sort of an effect in relation to the brain and psychiatric disorders. But exactly how that effect manifests, the mechanisms are pretty unknown at this point. A lot is unknown about the microbiota. There is an association with elevated cortisol for the majority of depressed individuals, and certain nutrients do seem to have a positive effect, like dark chocolate, omega-3s, and vitamin C, and potentially probiotics, although we kind of saw mixed results on that. BDNF is highly implicated in brain maintenance and remodeling, so remodeling being that neuroplasticity where neurons can communicate better with one another. They kind of reduce their interaction with certain neurons and they increase their interaction with other neurons, but it's all for the overall betterment of your ability to think. So it increases brain maintenance and remodeling, as well as reverses some of the bad effects. That's a terrible way to say it. The decrements that come from depression, you know, or the associations with atrophy, so brain getting smaller, and depressed people tend to have lower levels of this BDNF. A Western diet reduces its systemic levels, and calorie restriction, fasting, curcumin, resveratrol, among other nutrients, seem to have a positive effect in increasing BDNF levels, with the assumption that BDNF then protects the brain and allows it to continue to grow and to continue to adapt to its surroundings. So you're not going to get a whole lot of growth once you're an adult, but you will see a lot of remodeling that's occurring, even well into adulthood. Okay. Well, I've been talking for 45 minutes. Again, I knew that this review is just going to be too much for me to cover in one episode. So I'm glad I've given myself the breathing room to be able to discuss this stuff in more detail, although each episode is turning out to be close to an hour, so about 3 hours worth of how nutrition affects depression. But hopefully you're getting something out of it. I really do hope so. And with that said, I think I'll leave it here, and I will hopefully have the pleasure of speaking with you in the next podcast episode discussing nutrition on depression, and then we'll see what we'll cover in the coming weeks after that. Okay, have a wonderful one, and I will catch you in the next one. See ya.